unless, of course, the change makes a major improvement. Microsoft learned this lesson when working on OS 2. As Chris Peters recalled, OS 2 was an attempt where we tried to change things. They tried to make things 10% better, but completely different, and nobody wanted 10% better. We have a rule of thumb that things have to be twice as good before they can be different if you're trying for consistency. Peters recounted the example of the undo icon, a feature that existed first in Word. The Excel group developed an undo icon that works differently and tests 10% better in the usability lab. This is not good enough to warrant a different undo icon in Excel as opposed to Word because of the large number of people who use both programs, nor is it enough of an improvement for Word to adopt the Excel format. As Peters commented, obviously, if it's a lot better, then maybe we ought to think about it. If it's only a little bit better, then the lack of consistency becomes an issue as well. 20% tax for rewriting code. Another aspect of keeping products ready to ship is to invest in rewriting code in between projects. This resembles maintenance or product re-engineering work in some other software companies, although Microsoft has no separate groups for this work. As an informal guideline, development managers try to allocate about 20% of their developers' time to reworking weak parts of the product. If they do this consistently over multiple versions, the product will consistently improve. If they do not, the overall quality may deteriorate as developers add different features and as users demand more functionality from the product. Chris Peters said that, "We have this thing called the 20% tax, which is related to rewriting or re-architecting certain parts of the product. If you don't pay the 20% tax, then you end up in a bad situation. So you try to pick the part that's the worst." Often, projects use this time to rework parts of the program that are important but not highly visible to the user. Examples are storing names in Excel, moving from 256 fonts to 4,000 fonts in Word, rewriting how a program prints, or making more fundamental changes in the way features operate or interact. Microsoft people consider this work a tax in the sense that projects reserve about one day a week of the developer's time to make improvements in the fundamental structures of a product rather than to add new features. Developers often spend this time during the period immediately after they release a product, called Milestone Zero in Chapter 4, and before the official beginning of the development phase for the next product version. Build multiple product versions simultaneously. It is also critical for Microsoft's competitive strategy to have versions of each product simultaneously ready for different hardware platforms, as well as for different markets around the world. Projects leverage resources by trying to maximize the common code shared across product versions for debugging, final release, different hardware and operating system platforms, and different end-user languages. Such sharing allows projects to develop and test all these versions at the same time. The Excel group, for example, built 20 different versions of the Excel 4.0 product to accommodate 5 different language areas: United States, German, French, Spanish, and Far East, Japanese, Chinese, and Korean, Windows and Macintosh operating platforms, and both a production or ship version and a debug version, which contains extra code for testing and error detection for each language platform combination. Microsoft releases only 10 of these versions to customers, since projects use debug versions internally. Excel provides a good example of how projects prepare to ship these multiple versions. During a project, developers separate the language-specific portions of the product, such as text for error message and dialog boxes, into a separate file. This separation allows them to translate these portions into a foreign language by simply translating the contents of a single file. Microsoft groups call this translation process localization. Developers can then focus on the language-independent portions of the code that all language versions will share. Mark Olson commented on the separation of the language-independent code and the language-dependent portions in the product. The U.S. version is the one we spend most of our time on. All of our language-specific parts of the product, like all of the UI, user interface, that gets localized or translated, gets put into a separate DLL, dynamic link library file, that we call a language DLL. So we will just build a single Excel.exe, executable file, and then have a DLL for each language. The code is the same in the French version as in the US version, but the UI specifics are taken into a DLL. The translation of the language-dependent localization files happens relatively late in the development phase, when the user interface is stable. Projects want the features to stabilize first, so they do not have to retranslate user interface text as the features change. The actual translation of the localization files occurs just before a project releases the US version or shortly thereafter. The separation of the language-dependent localization files from the language-independent code allows testers to spend their time efficiently by focusing primarily on testing the localized portions of an international product. Olson explained how this process works. That allows us to separate the localization of the product, the testing of the translation, and the localization in terms of dialogues, menus containing strings, and sort order. We do that testing last, and the testing we do along the way is to make sure things like country settings don't matter, so the code accounts for country settings as part of the core code. There is nothing special we do in the French version. It's all part of the same code base. So, for each feature, people have to understand the implications of changing the code page or changing the country settings on their feature. For some features, it doesn't matter at all. For a feature like format number, where you're looking at currency formats or date separators or list separators, you have to make sure you're getting the information from the right place. Nothing is hard-coded. The Office project creates a similar number of versions of its product suite. Office builds a Win32, 32-bit version, and one or two Macintosh versions for the Power Mac and the older Macintosh products based on the Motorola 68000 processor chip family. They also build a production and debug version for each platform, and they have different localization files for each language. The Far East version for Office will eventually require a separate build, and not just a localization file, because Microsoft is adopting the Unicode standard. Unicode uses 2 bytes for each character, as opposed to the existing approach of 1 byte per character, supplemented with special extensions, in order to provide broad support for kanji characters. Releasing products for multiple platforms and markets. The real benefit of building multiple versions of a product simultaneously is that Microsoft can ship versions for different platforms and markets within a short time of one another. The company goal is to have a simultaneous shipment, called a SimShip, for every major product on each major platform and for each language market. This means releasing the versions within about 30 days of each other. Releasing different versions within a narrow period of time is essential to marketing products successfully. Foreign customers tend to stop buying old versions of a product if they hear that a new version is available in the United States, just as Macintosh customers tend to stop buying old versions of Excel and Word if they hear that a new Windows version is available. Although shipping versions within 30 days of one another is the goal, Microsoft will release some minor language versions over a longer period. For example, Excel 4.0 shipped in the US Windows version first. The French and German Windows versions came 30 days later, but the Spanish Windows version came 60 days after the US version. Excel 4.0 shipped in the US Macintosh version about 20 days after the US Windows version, and the international Macintosh versions came out with the same 30 and 60-day delays that the Windows versions had. For Windows 95, the goal is to ship the kanji version within 3 months of the US version. The Windows 95 code also provides the basis for a Middle East version and a Far East version. These staggered releases mostly reflect logistical delays and testing, according to Mark Olson. Everything is spread out, partly because of the need of some last-minute logistical details. There's things that you don't think about. The software is pretty much ready to go, It's getting the documentation done. It's getting the README files that go on the disk done. It's getting the setup program finalized. It's getting all the example files and any add-ins we ship finally done. It's just maintaining that list of files to make sure they're the right ones and that they have all had a chance to be looked at. The sales volume is not yet too large in some international markets, but Microsoft invests in foreign language versions when managers believe these markets will eventually be substantial. For example, the Hebrew version of Word sells relatively few copies, yet Microsoft people want to have a presence in many Middle East countries, and they view China as a huge eventual market as well. Chris Williams, Microsoft's Director of Product Development, described this investment strategy. The Middle East group is there, outside of the product business units, because we wanted to isolate our investment in that area. If we were to put the development of Hebrew Word in the Word group, and all of its 1,200 copies, or whatever that it will sell, the Word people would completely ignore it, or they would put more effort into it than was appropriate. The point is that you couldn't judge how much effort was being put into it. So we have allocated those people to that market space with the charge of providing the products necessary for us to have a presence in that market space on an investment basis. Right now, they have horrendously bad intellectual property laws, so the people steal the software 90% of the time. But we know that 20% of the world speaks Arabic, and sooner or later, we'll make some money in that market space. So right now, we have a strategy that says we will spend just about as much as we make. We have a very concrete investment, and it just about exactly pays for our income in that neighborhood. The people in Japan, the Far East, are managing the China effort, which is the other significant one that we are investing in on a cost basis. We're just flooding that market with copies. The goal is that when people actually end up having to buy software, they will already know our software, and it's the one they will buy when the laws get passed. We're basically getting market share. As soon as we start to get a return on that investment, it will be humongous. Principle: speak a common language on a single development site. To help people communicate across and within groups, Microsoft groups do their development work at the company headquarters outside Seattle. They also speak a common language. That is, they adopt a small set of development languages, conventions, and tools. This common base of understanding how to create products helps Microsoft personnel communicate and solve problems relatively quickly and effectively. Single-site development. Microsoft has continued to honor the tradition of doing all major development efforts at the Microsoft headquarters. There are only a few exceptions to this rule. There are some overseas adaptation projects, like the Japanese version of Windows, which Microsoft later moved to the United States, and certain applications products and tool development work, like PowerPoint and Softimage, are off-site because they originated as Microsoft acquisitions. As noted in Chapter 1, however, Bill Gates in particular wants groups to be able to solve problems and technical interdependencies face-to-face. Despite the benefits of electronic mail and its extensive usage at Microsoft, single-site development allows project personnel to get together physically on a regular basis and explore ideas interactively. Frequent and easy communication can prevent major problems from getting worse. Dave Moritz emphasized the benefits. Location, single-site development, is so, so important. One of the reasons that Windows 3.1 still hasn't got off in Japan is that it was developed across in Japan. And there was just the Japanese mentality of trying to hide what was going on from us, because that's how they want to work, and their managers do not let two people speak together. That's why it's now been brought across to here. In Chicago, Windows 95, we've just been able to get up and walk down the corridor and find out what's going on. It's what I call the whites of your eyes. If you can't see the whites of a person's eyes once a day, then you've got a problem. And that was one of the problems with OS 2, the Microsoft-IBM joint project done in the 1980s, this multi-site development. Microsoft managers have also been willing to invest in the infrastructure to support people at the Microsoft headquarters. Nearly everyone, except for summer interns and an occasional new hire, gets an individual office. Many offices have windows because of the layout of the buildings in an X configuration. Product units also generously provide project personnel with whatever computers and tools they need, including several different desktop machines, usually one Windows PC, one Macintosh, and a third of either type, fully loaded with software and networking capabilities. The C programming language. Microsoft projects implement, code their products using the C programming language, as well as a limited amount of C++ and assembler. Many companies use the C language in commercial software products because it is very portable across different hardware platforms, runs efficiently, and provides great implementation flexibility. The C language itself is independent of any hardware platform, unlike assembler, but the underlying system functions that a C program uses, called libraries, especially the user interface libraries, are platform-specific. Writing programs in C thus helps but does not ensure portability. Microsoft has achieved success in porting its code to many platforms, Windows, DOS, and Macintosh, because it also uses internally developed tools to evaluate code portability, and it develops core code for certain products that it can recompile on different platforms without making major changes. Excel 4.0, for example, contained about 69% core code shared across the Windows and Macintosh platforms. Core code has many benefits for the producer. As we noted in Chapter 3, though, the first attempt to use Windows Macintosh core code in Word 6.0 caused some performance as well as look and feel problems on the Macintosh. In spite of the portability, efficiency, and flexibility advantages of the C language, some people in the software development community feel C is too primitive and encourages developers to use unnecessary implementation tricks. Bill Gates acknowledged the disadvantages of C, but maintained that Microsoft developers work to generalize or abstract their code. Like everybody else, we haven't figured out how you write code in anything other than C. Now, C is a very low-level language, and we're using C++ for a lot of things. We're abstracting a lot of things. The C++ language encourages developers to write highly structured code that abstracts general concepts and hides details. Microsoft has adopted C++ where appropriate on selected projects, for example, some new components of Office and Windows NT, but C is still dominant. Gates also emphasized that Microsoft was using object abstraction and reuse concepts called object-oriented programming long before a language like C++ directly supported them. This attests to the general skills of Microsoft developers. He also argued, however, that Microsoft does not promote these implementation or methodology details as an advantage of its products. Many people will say, "Oh, object-oriented programming is going to cause a factor of 10 improvement." Yes, it's a benefit, because the tools are going to encourage it more, and it's going to allow for more sharing and all that. But the pieces of code we wrote 10 years ago use those same abstractions. We passed procedural pointers around, so you can have different data structures and use common subroutines. It's only a matter of degree. And frankly, there's a lot of potential abuse that comes with that, in terms of understanding efficiency, and really knowing that you have factored things in a way that it's appropriate to share those things in the future. A lot of people are going to fall into the trap of that promised land. That's why you haven't seen us out, even though we write massive amounts of C++ code, acting like, "Oh, customers should buy our detergent because it has objects in it." If it runs faster, if it has more features, yes, you should buy it. It doesn't matter if we use squirrels to create the thing. So we don't brag about what methodology we did or didn't use in terms of end users of the product. The Hungarian Naming Convention. Many Microsoft applications projects, as well as a few systems projects, use a Microsoft code naming convention called Hungarian, after its originator, Charles Simony, who was born in Hungary. Microsoft Hungarian is unrelated to the Hungarian language spoken in Europe. A naming convention is an explicit name usage pattern or style that a developer can use for procedures and variables in source code. It should increase the readability and understandability of such code for developers who are trying to modify or reuse the code. A common problem in software development is that source code is often not comprehensible by anyone other than the person who originally wrote it. Yet many people have to be able to read, understand, and modify product source code reliably, so that developers can work in parallel, as well as reuse, change, or fix other people's code. Use of Hungarian at Microsoft started when Simone arrived from Xerox PARC to work on Multiplan in 1981. See Chapter 3. He and others, such as former senior developer Doug Klunder, heavily promoted its use among the applications groups where Simone and Klunder worked during the 1980s. The Hungarian naming convention gives developers the ability to read other people's code relatively easily, with a minimum number of comments in the source code. John Devon estimated that only about 1% of all lines in the Excel product code consist of comments, but the code is still very understandable due to the use of Hungarian. If you look at our source code, you also notice very few comments. Hungarian gives us the ability to just go in and read code. Being fluent in Hungarian is almost like being some Greek scholar or something. You pick up something and you can read it. I remember starting at Microsoft thinking, "What's this? This is crazy. It doesn't make any difference." But it really does. In Hungarian, variable names have three parts: prefixes, a base type, and a qualifier. For example, the variable name PCH is a pointer to a character. The P is a prefix that means pointer, and the CH is a base type that means character. The name PCH first is a pointer referring to the first element of an array of characters. First is a qualifier that means the first element in a set. While this may seem straightforward, names can get more complicated. The variable name MPMIPFN is an array of pointers to functions indexed by MIs, which could be menu items. A developer could use such an array for command dispatch. The MP is a base type that means array, MI is the index type of the array, and PFN is the type of elements contained in the array, which are pointers, P, to functions, FN. In Hungary, people write the family name first and the given name second, just as Microsoft developers write the base type before the qualifier in their Hungarian. Most of the Office applications products continue to use Hungarian extensively. Only a small amount of old Excel code carried over from an early version of Multiplan does not use it. Practically all Word code uses Hungarian, except for some code that summer interns have written, although someone eventually goes over their code and rewrites it in Hungarian. Ed Fries noted that some people are very particular about the proper way to use the naming convention. It's like any language, it sort of has dialects, and some people are very strict about their Hungarian use, and others are a little less so. But it's such a part of our culture that I don't even think about it. Systems projects, however, do not use Hungarian very much. This may be because Hungarian and Charles Simone have not been a part of the culture of the systems division. Lou Perizzoli preferred not to debate the merits of the language convention too extensively, but he described his doubts as well as the experience of another developer on his team. Hungarian merely got in his way, didn't help him read the code at all, didn't help make the code more maintainable. The code that he looked at had as many bugs as other code he had seen. The applications people think it is great. We don't discourage people from using Hungarian, but nobody on my team, Windows NT, is working on the system proper using Hungarian. This is because it's not as descriptive as it seems. We never have somebody say, "Oh, gee, I didn't know that was an unsigned byte. I thought that was a signed byte." Those aren't the problems we have. The problems we have are synchronization problems. I think if I did an application, I wouldn't use Hungarian either. I think it is a religious issue, and you shouldn't debate religious issues. I personally grew up in a non-Hungarian world. We wrote huge systems. The system we worked on in NASA was a couple million lines of code, and it all worked. They did it by a top-down approach and very small procedures, even though it was written in Fortran. Common tools that support projects. Microsoft people also communicate well because projects use a common set of tools to help manage and develop products. Many tools are commercially available as Microsoft products. The bulk of the remainder are specialized internal tools or augmentations of commercial products that would not be viable in the marketplace due to lack of volume. Some of the internally available tools have also provided a major competitive advantage to Microsoft over the years. For example, Microsoft has been able to develop languages and applications very quickly for different hardware platforms and operating systems, such as the MIPS Altair, CPM, the Apple II, DOS, the Macintosh, and Windows. See Chapter 3. Bill Gates emphasized the virtues of creating and using your own tools. We have control over our tools because we use our own tools. There's a lot to be bragged about in this area. Why could we write software for the Macintosh and nobody else could? We wrote our own tools. Why does the company exist in the first place? We wrote our own tools. There were no tools nearly as good. It was a massive competitive edge. You just take simple things like the way we did memory pointer handling in our compiler for protect mode architecture. The one challenge this software company has is we write for real machines. When it was the 8088, we wrote for the 8088. When it was the 286 protect mode, we wrote for that machine. Then it was the Apple II. We make our software work. In terms of size and speed, there's no software company of any size that's even close on that. And controlling our own tools has been extremely helpful. Even today, we have things that do certain types of analysis. We just choose not to release those as products because they are a competitive advantage to us. There is no official list of a common Microsoft toolset, and any list would change over time and vary somewhat by product group. Most projects, though, use similar tools that we can describe here. Program managers often use Excel to manage a product specification and either Excel or Microsoft Project to track schedule information. They will use Word if they need to write and print a project document. Program managers generally use Visual Basic for prototyping product features. A version of this serves as a macro language in applications products, such as Excel, so that users can tailor the products to their needs. Developers often use Microsoft's commercial Visual C++ compiler for writing in C++, and Microsoft also has its own C compiler. Several projects have specialized internal code debuggers and analyzers to help understand and evaluate code. Editors vary by project and product. For example, Word uses a tool called the Brief Editor that includes many specialized macros to browse code and identify variable usage and function calling relationships. Developers currently use SLM for source code management, synchronization, and merging. Microsoft sells a commercial version of this called Delta. Microsoft also acquired the SourceSafe configuration management tool from OneTree Software when it bought this company in 1994. Some projects may switch to this instead of SLM or Delta. In the past, many developers used OS2 as their operating system platform when doing development work, primarily because of its multitasking capability. This allows several processes to execute at the same time. Now, however, most projects use Windows 95 or Windows NT. For example, Office builds on Windows NT, although it will later build on both Windows NT and Windows 95 to facilitate automatic testing. Testers use the internal RAID tool to record and track the status of product errors or bugs. Products that have extensive user interface testing often use Microsoft Test to capture and replay keyboard events automatically. Several projects use an internal test case manager, TCM, tool, which combines Visual Basic as a front-end with a structured query language, SQL, database. The tool organizes test scripts and logs test execution information. Having a common set of tools and development methods helps people adapt quickly when they move from product to product within the company. Gates felt that this was especially important. Well, we try not to let the way people use tools diverge too much from group to group, because we want people to be able to move between groups with great ease. We really encourage lots of moving around between groups so people can do a fresh new thing and can understand what the other groups are up to. We don't have much divergence in terms of the tools that people use nowadays. They all are equally good in some cases and bad in other cases. Once upon a time, there was a boundary. Systems had certain tools and apps had certain tools, but now that's basically resolved. Of course, in spite of Microsoft's strengths in tool development and usage, there is room for improvement. Some developers tolerate poor tools simply because they have become familiar with them, and they prefer to spend their time building products. Gates admitted that Microsoft has not invested as fully in some types of development tools as it should have. "We've had cases where we didn't invest enough in tools, and sometimes there's actually an outside tool that would be better. Many years ago, our debuggers weren't even that good. And we have some tools now that have to do with dynamic feedback, where you watch the profiles, and you go back and you change the compilation and memory organization based on that. Why didn't we do those years ago? I happen to think our source code control system is pretty crummy, although people use it. A lot of them stick up for it. But it's terrible, really. So people just get used to this stuff, even us, with all of our appropriate philosophy about investing in tools and being willing to take a long-term approach by investing in tools and all. On balance, it's been a huge asset. But we haven't executed on that fully the way that we should have. So that's a big negative." Even Microsoft's relatively crude tools, though, have their advantages. John Devon acknowledged that some of their tools, such as compilers and debuggers, look rather backward relative to what people studying computer science in universities are using. But he also argued that more sophisticated tools may not be as reliable. Furthermore, he has found that the Microsoft tools generate the best code for commercial purposes. "Our tools are pretty primitive compared to what I think people are used to from school. For Excel 4.0, actually, it was the first time we had source-level debugging, believe it or not. And mostly, I think that's a comment on the fact that the Microsoft tools have been kind of lagging. We use the Microsoft tools because they generate the best code of any of the other tools that we've evaluated. And to us, the punchline is the code that goes on the disk that we sell. And that's why we do that. Then you have a lot of people like myself. I prefer to use the assembly language debugger because it's faster and it works more reliably." Understand products at assembly code level. Most Microsoft developers have another ability in common. Like John Devon, they can understand how their software works at a very low level. They may not always choose to take advantage of this ability, however, for all users. In particular, sharing code between Windows and Macintosh versions often means that Microsoft developers give priority to the Windows code and try not to write low-level code for the different platforms. In general, however, it is extremely useful for developers to understand code at the deepest possible level. Then they can compensate for the limitations of Microsoft's compiler tools and make sure to ship code that executes as efficiently as possible, given the objectives of the project. Devon emphasized that in the Office and Excel groups, at least, the senior people insist that developers be able to read assembler. Managers will not simply let developers write code in a higher-level language, such as C or C++, and run it blindly through a compiler. A compiler automatically translates the high-level code into assembly code and then an even lower-level machine code that the computer can understand directly. On Excel 4.0, for example, the language composition was 75.7% C code, 10.8% assembler code, and 13.5% other code, such as include files and token files. Microsoft also used to write approximately 80% of Word in C and port this across the PC and Macintosh platforms, with 20% of the code in assembler. Increased use of assembler language can improve execution speed. For example, an evaluation using an automated macro test of new 32-bit versions of Excel and Word ran in 74 seconds on Windows NT 3.5. The older 16-bit product versions that contain more assembler code ran in 70 seconds. In addition to enhancing the speed of a product, some developers also need to understand the early MS-DOS code, which Microsoft and IBM wrote in Intel Assembler to minimize memory requirements and maximize processing speed. This deep product understanding also involves learning the constructs where the compilers generate bad code, then writing code to avoid or replace those constructs. Devon estimated that his developers read the assembly code generated by the compiler for more than 50% of the source code. He also complained that Microsoft has to teach developers to understand systems at this low level. The courses in computer science at universities generally do not adequately emphasize how to assure efficient use of memory and execution time, which has been critically important for selling software products for personal computers. Devon elaborated on these points. We do encourage people to understand how the system works at the very lowest level. Unfortunately, your tools don't work often enough, and things like Windows and the Mac system don't work often enough. So you have to get into that level to figure out why it doesn't work. That's one of the primary motivators. The other primary motivator is we're very interested in making sure that the best code goes out in the product. When you're looking at the machine instructions, you know what the quality of the code is. You also get to learn. It's the only way to learn. You can write good code in C, but you have to know how your compiler generates its code to be able to do that. And if you're always stepping through the source-level debugger, you have no clue. That's an attitude that we have to teach people. What people learn in school is that stuff doesn't matter. But when you're making a product that people want to buy, that stuff really matters. The idea is to learn the constructs that the compiler is bad at. We can ask the compiler guys to fix it, but to the extent that that's a long turnaround thing, we know just to write code which doesn't have that problem. Principle: continuously test the product as you build it. Several principles guide testing in Microsoft, and each helps teams continuously test their products as they build them. This notion of continual testing done concurrently with development distinguishes Microsoft. Too many software producers emphasize product testing primarily at the end of the development cycle, when fixing bugs can be extraordinarily difficult and time-consuming. In addition, Microsoft groups now test their products from a wide variety of perspectives. For example, projects create automated tests that developers can run every day on their code and must run before checking in their code changes to the master source code version. The test suites execute automatically by using a product's macro language or simulating keyboard strokes. Developers create debug versions of their products that contain special routines to help detect and locate bugs, as well as check for special conditions. And they also conduct code reviews to detect errors through code reading. Usability tests ask people off the street to evaluate the ease of use of product features in dedicated laboratories. Projects also pair testers with developers. There is about one tester for every developer at Microsoft. The testers read specifications to start preparing test cases and testing strategies early. Developers give private releases of their code to their testing buddies to test before they check in their code. Testers then use multiple approaches. One consists of highly structured test scripts called scenario-based testing. Another is guerrilla testing, where testers do not follow a script, but try everything they can think of to break the product. In addition, Microsoft projects hold bug bashes, which are parties where various people come by to try to find bugs. Project members also use the products they are building, distribute early versions internally, and send out thousands of beta copies to lead users, all in an effort to find bugs before releasing a product to the marketplace. In order to test as quickly as possible and encourage testers to acquire expertise in functional areas, Projects organize a typical product test group into parallel teams that each focus on particular feature areas. For example, the XL 5.0 testing team consisted of 45 people responsible for testing XL, MS Graph, and Query Tool. They also developed and tested the internal TCM test case management tool. The project organized the 45 people into six testing teams of 6 to 9 people each. Of course, due to the complexity of software products and the constraints of time schedules and manpower budgets, testing is as much an art as it is a science. The inability to test a product completely is also, unfortunately, part of the business. Microsoft products have improved continually, but they are certainly not perfect, especially in their first versions or when they contain totally new features. In the past, Microsoft has also introduced some products to market without adequate testing. This has become much less common with its new development approach and the gradual refinement of metrics to determine when a product is ready to ship. Microsoft will also now extend beta testing and delay the final release, especially with systems products, if features are not working fully or if bug levels are higher than desirable at the target ship date. Windows 95, which has a large amount of new code and complex new features, such as plug-and-play and the multitasking of applications programs, is a recent example of this type of delay. Quick tests. A key tool in making the daily build process work efficiently is a highly automated set of tests called a quick test. After a developer has implemented a new feature, but before he has checked in the source code changes to the master version of the source code files, he builds a private release of the product. See step 7 in the daily build process described in table 5.1. He then executes the quick test on his private release. This makes sure that basic functionality in the product still works correctly after he has added the new feature. See step 9. A product's macro language provides an effective mechanism for automating these quick tests, in addition to its use as a way for users to customize and extend the product functionality. The quick test does not test a new feature directly. It just makes sure that a developer's changes do not interfere with some other features of the product and cause errors indirectly. If the quick test is successful, the developer then checks in his code changes. The fact that Microsoft has automated the quick test is critical because many developers execute the test a large number of times, and it checks for many special cases that developers may forget. Nonetheless, developers cannot rely completely on the quick test and need to talk with other developers in their area, as Ed Fries described. From a testing point of view, one way to do it is a lot of automation. From a developer's point of view, it's very rare that you're doing something truly new. And hopefully, when you go to put something in, you look for something similar in the code, and you imitate it. There you'll see all these special cases, like pieces of code saying, if the recorder's on, and I'm doing something special to the recorder, and you think, what about undo? And here's some undo stuff. That's really the best way to catch cases that might not be obvious to you. Then, the other thing is that we rely a lot on experts in the group. There are various experts in various areas. A lot of stuff has to happen just with people talking. Testing buddies and private releases. The principle of continuous and concurrent testing also means that testers must work literally side by side with developers as they are writing code. At the same time, to ensure some detachment from the code, Microsoft's philosophy is that testing must remain a separate function from development. As we described in chapters 1 and 2, testers do not report to the development group or the program managers. They report to the test manager, who reports to the product unit manager. But projects achieve this side-by-side closeness by assigning developers and testers to work together in teams on particular features. In addition, testers not only test new code, but also have the opportunity to review specifications as they evolve and write test cases in parallel with the evolution of the code. Chris Peters stressed the importance of this close interaction between developers and testers. You need separate but equal organizations in development and testing so that it keeps you from shipping bad stuff. Development and testing need to be deeply intermingled, or else you have this terrible Inspector 12 phenomenon, where developers throw things over the wall. What we do now is testers and developers, at least test and feature teams, are usually assigned to each other, so they tend to work with each other quite closely. As we outlined earlier, many Microsoft developers generate a personal daily build of the evolving product each day, regardless of whether they plan to check in code changes that day. See steps 3 and 7 in Table 5.1. The resulting private release incorporates the latest version of a developer's changes before he has checked these into the master version of the source code. The developer shares his private release with his assigned testing buddy. This lets testers gauge the progress of features and also prevent many errors from entering the master version of the source code. Mark Olson pointed out how this technique in itself creates a close working relationship between developers and testers. It also gives developers more time to spend on writing code and fixing problems. The goal of private release testing is to find defects before they get into real production code, or into code that is part of this main source code library, before it is shared with all of the other developers on the team. They have to work around the problems you have introduced by checking in your code. So there are some pretty strict rules about private release testing. It is just developer and tester, and they develop a working relationship. Depending upon the level of trust that gets developed there, they can be a really tight team. The developer can focus on writing code and fixing problems, and the tester can focus on getting this feature really quickly stabilized. A developer will put a feature through private release testing at least once before checking in his code, and often will do this on a daily basis. Ed Fries believed that informal private release testing reduces the time between when a tester discovers a bug and a developer corrects it. We like to try to make a private release to testing before we move off from one feature to the next. That means writing up a testing release document and making a special version of your feature available for testing. This is for a kind of pre-testing that doesn't go into the bug database to make sure that things are stable. It lets you go through a lot of the quick bugs. We get faster turnaround than when you go through a more formal bug database process. Debug code. We mentioned in the discussion of multiple versions that in the development phase for a product, Microsoft developers create debug versions of their products. These result from inserting various forms of specialized tests, or debug code, into the product source code. When a developer does a build, he switches on the debug code as part of the debug release. He switches it off for the production release, so the version that ships to customers does not include the extra code. Developers usually access the debug code via an invisible menu on the product user interface. For example, Word's invisible menu is next to the help selection. Developers must write their own debug code as part of their regular work. Fries noted that they have to plan to develop debugging aids. Otherwise, people do not do them. Whenever we're scheduling out all the new features for the product, we try and think, well, what are the infrastructure things that we should be doing as well? Let's make sure we save some time and schedule some time for that work too, or it's just not going to get done. We try and schedule a few things every version that are infrastructure type things that will add to the whole program. We schedule those along with normal features. The debug code mainly provides automated built-in tests for monitoring the execution of the product and checking for exceptional conditions. These help developers tune and improve the memory usage and execution speed of the product. When using the debug code, developers can also use the source code or an assembly debugger tool to view internal data structures while a program is executing. Fries described an example of dual redundant implementations of features in Word. The team has implemented one set of routines in the C language and another set of routines in the native computer's low-level assembly language. They do this for efficiency and portability trade-offs. Something that's really right that we do in our apps is we build a lot of debugging code into them. This is true in both Word and Excel. When the apps are so big, that's part of a nice framework that you want to build for supporting it, for making it easier to track down problems. One example is Word has C and native versions. It has C versions for all of its assembly versions of routines. So if we have a routine that we've written in hand assembly, we also have the C version. And in our debug version, we include both. We can switch, just on the fly, between using the C versions and using the assembly versions. A common problem when you have C and assembly versions of the same thing is that they get out of sync. It helps to keep them in sync. In fact, you can turn on a verify mode where it runs both, one right after another, and make sure that the result is the same. There are actually many examples of debug code that Microsoft developers use to improve quality or efficiency in the products they are building. In total, these can amount to tens of thousands of lines of code, even on a small product. Of particular importance are memory and data structure checks, assertions, and instrumentation, instrumented product versions. Debug code also plays a particularly important role in weekly releases of the product build to the testing groups. Memory and data structure checks. Memory checks account for every byte of memory that a program uses or allocates. For example, if an automated audit of the memory fails, then a MIF, Memory Integrity Failure, message appears. A similar technique, called data structure checks, uses special routines that validate the consistency of nearly every data structure in the product. These make sure that the program has stored the data properly and can retrieve it. They are a type of default idle time process, which does the checks automatically when the computer's processor has idle time. Other similar types of debug code simulate resource allocation failures. For example, Excel can simulate failures for nearly all calls to operating system functions. It does this by adding a repetitive loop to the program and bottlenecking most Excel functions through a command dispatcher. The loop sets the threshold for resource allocation failure, then calls a particular function from the operating system. The function eventually fails at some point due to the defined threshold and returns a failure status. The loop then does memory allocation checks and data structure consistency checks. If there are no problems, the debug code increases the failure threshold to the next highest level and continues testing. If the operating system function fails, then the debug code has detected a problem, and it shows an error message to the developer. Other debug code examples are movable memory checks, dynamic relocation, called shaking of the memory allocated in the heap, and forced failures. The heap is the region of memory that a program allocates and deallocates for data storage while it is executing. Assertions. Very common examples of debug code are assertions. These are if-then tests in the code that must always be true, regardless of the input data from a user. For example, a banking application product may use an assertion that tests the balance of a checking account after a transaction. It might say, if the balance is greater than or equal to $0, then OK, else failure. This assertion statement should always be true. Many Microsoft products tend to have a global state of information that they share throughout the program. Developers often use assertions to check their assumptions about the global state of the program or particular arguments passed into or out of a function. Many bugs occur when people write code without fully considering the program's global state or these arguments. As a result, many projects have an informal rule that developers must include assertions when they make assumptions about data stored elsewhere in the program. John Devon explained that assertions make it possible to track down bugs relatively quickly. Assertions are pretty important because one of the big sources of bugs is people writing code when they don't understand the global state, or they're assuming something about the global state. We try to build the habit that if you assume something about global state, you have to assert it in the code you are writing. And the same thing with arguments. If you're assuming something about the arguments to your function, you have to assert it. With enough assertions, you get to see the bug right away. instrumentation. Developers also insert probes into the code that capture which commands users select and which corresponding statements in the source code get executed. Microsoft calls a product release containing these probes an instrumented version. With the user's consent and agreement to send back the results, these versions can become a valuable addition to internal testing, usability testing, and field beta testing. The data resulting from the instrumentation allows developers to recreate users' actions easily, understand their problems, and avoid being unable to reproduce errors. For example, developers were able to reproduce 96.6% of the reported errors in Works for Windows 2.0 and 91.4% of the reported errors in Windows NT PDK 2. The amount of data that instrumented versions of products can generate is enormous. In fact, Bill Gates boasted that Microsoft has databases containing millions of commands that users have executed. They, developers and testers, also take what's called the instrumented version. That's the version that records what commands people are using, what errors they get, what sequence that's done in. We can do a lot of analysis of what's going on. Why do people get error messages? What commands do they really use commonly? What commands do they use in a sequence so that we might be able to capture that at a task level? We have literally millions of commands that users have given in the instrumentation database. Instrumentation also indicates which parts of the source code users have exercised heavily or lightly. Software developers call this execution coverage. Testing that forces 100% execution coverage helps reveal bugs lurking in seldom exercised parts of the source code. Devon observed that projects commonly do execution coverage testing late in development using automated tests, such as a small set of programs written in a macro language that combine many operations. Some amount of the final debugging time will be spent with developers helping the testers get their auto test to cover a higher percentage of code. Weekly testing releases. During the development phase, developers give the daily build for the product to the testing group once each week. This weekly testing release tends to use the debug version because the facilities to this version, like assertions, show problems sooner. As the project approaches the ship date, the developers will do weekly releases of the production version, which does not contain the extra thousands of lines of debug code, more often than the debug version. Testers may also write their own routines to test code and then add them to the program, according to Freeze. We have some pretty sophisticated testers. There's a group who are basically programmers. They usually know what they want and come and say, "Do we have permission to go in and insert a few built-in tests in your code here and there that we're going to use to test it better?" And of course we say, "Sure." Code reviews. Before implementing features, Microsoft groups do a limited amount of formal, intensive design reviews. These try to detect cases of missing code or consistency problems earlier than the later testing activities that require a running product. Generally, however, Microsoft groups do not do deep, comprehensive design or code reviews for their products because they specify only an outline of the product functionality before they start writing code. See the discussion of the outline specification approach in Chapter 4. Moreover, because specifications and code also change a great deal during a project, it is sometimes difficult to determine when to hold reviews. With the pressure of their short development cycles, Microsoft people have not had the time to study if it is better to spend more time up front doing more reviews and design work, or to devise better ways of checking for these problems later. John Devon, for example, tries to think of all possibilities and contingencies that might cause problems when he is implementing a feature, but he does not necessarily do this when he is designing the feature. We've kind of given up on thinking that we can think of all the cases ahead of time. That's why we leave a fair amount of flexibility for when we're actually implementing the feature. We could probably reduce the number of cases by having more formalized design reviews, but no way would we eliminate it. And so then the question is, how do you find them faster? Do you find them faster by testing, or do you find them faster by thinking ahead of time? Senior developers do tend to review the code of new people, or people working on a new area of a product, to check their quality and to help them learn. Usually, the best expert available, sometimes the team leader and sometimes the person's mentor, will review a new person's code before that person checks it in. The code reviews provide an effective peer-to-peer mechanism for learning implementation tips, as Devon related. New people, we review their code. When someone's working on a new assignment and maybe someone else was the expert in that area, then before they check in code, they'll have the best expert review their code. He'll tell them, this was done right, or this is a better way to do this thing. The idea is that everyone is going to learn by doing, and so people do. Mentors will answer questions and stuff to help them get along, but when they think they're done with the code, they'll get a code review to get tips. Testing releases and test release document. We noted that projects periodically make a testing release of their evolving product available to the product's test group. Testers record errors detected in the testing releases in a bug database managed by the RAID tool, and managers use these bug data for progress tracking. A group will usually build a testing release each week throughout a project and attach a test release document called a TRD to the release. Excel 5.0, for example, built its weekly testing release on a Monday night and made it available on Tuesday. The test release document describes each feature at the time of its initial completion and handover to testing. Developers generate this document for their testers, and developers generally write their portions of it prior to testing their private releases. The size of the document varies with the size of the features. It explains to the testers how the features work so that they can test them effectively. The testers also use the specification document as another source of testing information. Ed Fries explained the role of the test release document. There are some documents that we do require the programmers to generate, and those tend to deal with how they interact with other groups. When they create a new feature and they're ready to move on to the next one, they have to submit this to testing and work with testing. They need to come up with a test release document that explains to them how this feature works, what kinds of things they should look at, and what kinds of things they should be testing. Usability testing. A very different kind of testing that Microsoft projects do, mainly during the development phase, is usability testing of new features in a formal laboratory environment. Also see our discussion of this in Chapter 6. This testing is especially appropriate for user interfaces and features in applications products. Both should emphasize ease of use. Microsoft has a dedicated centralized staff of 30 to 35 specialists to evaluate almost all applications products and some of the systems products by various usability criteria. Since this testing goes on continuously, it represents an enormous investment of time, but generates invaluable customer feedback during a project. Bill Gates commented on the extensive usability testing process for Office. "We take the prototype that we build based on all this work, and we put it into our usability labs, where we watch people actually sit in front of the application. Once again, that's feedback. We use that to refine again and again." For Office 4.0, there were over 8,000 hours of usability testing done before we decided we had it right and we wanted to put it out to the marketplace. Other companies have usability labs that they use to test new product ideas or improve existing products. Microsoft takes this idea to an extreme, however, and has made evaluating features for usability a regular part of the development process. When developers think they are done or almost done with a feature, program managers schedule the feature to appear in the usability lab. Sometimes developers do a special version or a mock-up of the feature if they have not finished but want to test a prototype in the lab anyway. Generally, every feature in an application product that affects the user goes through the usability lab. Each feature team lead manages the team schedule, and there is also a master schedule for the whole project. Program managers use this information on feature availability to schedule features into the usability lab. During a typical usability test, the lab staff recruits groups of 10 people from off the street to represent different types of users. They sit in special individual rooms. The lab staff asks them to do a specific task using a product. For example, to create a new document or organize financial data into quarterly summaries, and the usability specialists watch and videotape the user actions from behind one-way mirrors. Many times, the people do not receive much guidance, so if the product is not easy to understand, they will be unable to complete the task. The usability testers document problems that the users have and the percentage of users that complete each task successfully without referring to a manual. The testers do about 2 lab tests a week for a particular product, and they evaluate about 3 features in each half-day session. Developers see the reports on problems people had in the lab and discuss reactions to them with program managers and the usability testers. The usability lab does not generally support overall product planning, such as helping projects make major decisions on activities. That is the purpose of the activity-based planning technique discussed in Chapter 4. Rather, Microsoft uses the labs more to provide almost instant feedback to help developers decide how to make new or existing features simple to understand. Developers, for example, often have to trade off more than one appearance or behavior for a feature. They also have to resolve detailed user interface design issues or choose between a small set of features that do similar functions to see which feature is easiest to use. Most developers visit the lab to witness their features in action. This lets them learn about problems firsthand, as Ed Fries explained. The programmers tend to go out to the usability labs when their individual features are usability tested. They watch people use it, see what kinds of problems they're having, and come up with ideas on their own for making things better. So usability testing probably has a bigger influence than other testing from day to day on what we're producing. The labs, however, have some limitations. They tend to model the new user much better than the experienced user, and they work best on well-defined questions. Nonetheless, there are important advantages to usability testing. It allows Microsoft to continue to add new, powerful features and avoid less useful ones, sometimes critically called feature creep, as well as continue to make added features easy to use. The usability lab also has several advantages over beta testing, which provides information very late and often lacks detail. As Chris Peters elaborated,